Someone has asked me a few times to give a talk on forgiveness. So I thought tonight I would talk about forgiveness. The issue of forgiveness is a current event in various ways. We have, in August, it was very pertinent for our whole country with the issue of the forgiveness of the apology of the president. But it appears other places. I was very much touched by the whole process in South Africa of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee there and their work. And they just in the last few weeks finished their work and submitted their report. And the whole issue of forgiveness came up quite dramatically in South Africa, where there were such atrocious acts of violence done, and family survivors or people who were maimed faced the people who had done the damage, and some of them could do forgiveness and some of them couldn't. And to hear those stories, especially the ones who could do forgiveness, but all the stories, was quite touching to me. And then also, maybe it's always there periodically in the news, but I've been sensitive in the last months about the number of reports about the issue of forgiveness around the death penalty in our country. Some of the articles I've read have been from family of victim members who have been murdered, or people who have been seriously injured or attacked or left for dead but survived. And their relationship to the death penalty of the person who committed the crime, and some you find these very dramatic cases of forgiveness. People forgive the family person forgives the murderer of their son or their daughter or whatever, and to hear their accounts of how they forgave and why they forgave, it touches and moves me a lot. Our beloved president has also been trying to raise the issue of race, the race issue in our culture, to kind of help clarify and maybe heal some of the great racial divides. And one of the questions that came up was, would President Clinton apologize for slavery? It seems like it's overdue. And as you see in many countries, you know, people apologize for different things that they've done many years later. And would he apologize? And so the issue of apology, and then maybe perhaps connected to that, is forgiveness. If the powers that be forgive, apologize for the crimes committed, the tremendous damage committed to the African-American community, could there be some forgiveness that they would offer back? And I've read, I just keep coming across these wonderful accounts of people who've gone through great suffering. Recently I read an account in Nicaragua of after the Somoza was kicked out of power and the Sandinistas came in. Regardless of what you think of the Sandinista government, one of the remarkable things about that was the amount of forgiveness that that country was able to exhibit towards the atrocious, almost genocide kind of behavior of the Somoza government. There was one story, a very famous story in Nicaragua, of one of the, I think maybe the Minister of Justice or something like that, in the new Sandinista government. He had been tortured himself and almost died in prison by the Somoza government, and he went into a prison to do some kind of review or something. And this was a prison where they were holding a lot of the torturers and murderers from the Somoza regime, and he came across the man who tortured him, who was being held there. And so the torturer asked, now the free minister said, "What are you going to do with me now that you caught me and recognize me here?" And I don't know if this is exactly the spirit of forgiveness, but he said to his torturer, "I'm going to condemn you, or something like this, by forgiving you. That was the most pointed thing he could do in return, was to forgive him. And I guess the reason it was pointed was that he left the torturer with his own conscience. And that's all that was left. It wasn't, he didn't have to worry about what society was going to do against him, but just left with his own conscience. And this, I think, is what part of the great power of mindfulness practice is, that as we become more sensitive and quiet inside of ourselves, one of the things we're left with is, it's not exactly a Buddhist word, but we're left with our conscience. And we get to see both tremendous suffering we might hold inside, the wounds that some people have, and we might see the suffering we hold from the things, the acts that we've done in our lives. It's the stuff that are still buried deep inside of us, still bother us, but have been covered up by distractions. It's somewhat common for people who are new to meditation, at some point, maybe, I don't know when, but at some point, to remember things that they've done. Maybe sometimes it could be 20, 30, 40 years earlier, and it looms up in their meditation, and kind of the memory is released, and then they decide, oh, this is, I have to do something about this now. I have to go apologize to someone. And they'll call someone up and say, remember what I did 30 years ago? No. But I appreciate your apology anyway. So forgiveness. And to understand the connection between mindfulness practice and forgiveness, you have to understand that forgiving is only an issue when resentment or regret exists. That if a person holds no resentment, I don't think there's really an issue of forgiving, particularly. And this is a wonderful, interesting thing, that the wonderful ideal of forgiveness exists kind of in the messiness of there being some holding or resistance or frozen anger, which is how I call resentment. It's kind of very somewhat similar to the idea that compassion, which is also a wonderful ideal, exists in proximity to suffering. Compassion is born in the messiness of life again, not kind of in the abstract, kind of thinking kind of abstractly what a good idea it is and then kind of mustering up some compassion. But compassion is born when we really feel and sense the great difficulty that exists in life and that people experience. So this ideal of forgiveness exists when there is resentment. And so it's really coming to terms with resentment itself, the practice of forgiveness. Now, mindfulness practice is powerful in that one of the things it does is it ferrets out all the ways our heart and mind is closed. All the holding, all the being closed down, the holding back, all the barriers and defensive barriers we sometimes put up, all the resistance, all the kind of hardnesses that we take on that are sometimes symptoms of our fear and our aversion, our ambition and our anger. These get ferreted out. They kind of get revealed as the mind gets more settled and more calm. And these different places where these kind of holdings are in place are kind of like sniffed out. It's like mindfulness is like this hunting dog that kind of, you know, eventually none of it will get, none of it can remain hidden. Eventually all of it gets revealed. And sometimes it's sooner rather than later, sometimes later rather than sooner. But the part of the powerful mindfulness is it really is this kind of meeting. We meet the places of holding, of clinging. And in that, resentment is one of those types of clinging. We meet that also through the mindfulness practice. It wasn't obvious to me, this is maybe an obvious statement, but it wasn't obvious to me when I was younger, and maybe it's a symptom of age. But maybe it's also a symptom of the kind of sensitivity that comes from practice. And that is, I realize more and more how all of us have been hurt. All of us have been disappointed. All of us have failed according to some kind of standard or some kind of idea we have about failure and success. It's part of the human condition to have these things happen to us. To have hurt and disappointment and failures, you know, is part of what it means to be a human being. And I think many of us have some kind of almost an unconscious notion sometimes that something is wrong with us fundamentally as human being if we get hurt or disappointed or betrayed or something by people around us. And of course, it's not right. It shouldn't these things shouldn't happen in a way. But we're not, you know, less human because those things happen. It happens to everyone, these things. And then to see it happening to everyone can sometimes make it a little bit easier to be with, because maybe we don't take it so personal. It's part of the human condition. We don't have to be perfect. We don't have to get through from birth to death, as if we lived in a 1950s sitcom. So as we encounter our holdings and our blocks, we have to decide what to do with it, what to do with them. One of the interesting things that some of the articles around the death penalty, some of these family members who have forgiven the person who's on death row and maybe have even lobbied to try to get the person off death row because they don't believe in death penalty. Or sometimes people have, some victims or families of victims have actually followed and been there in the room, so they kind of watch, you know, through the glass, I guess, watch the execution of the person who's been condemned to death. And one of the interesting statements that some of these people make is that the execution didn't help too much. It tends to bring some relief, but it doesn't bring release. And one of the very important distinctions is the distinction between relief and release. And many people confuse the two, or many people don't know about the possibility of release, and they pursue actually a possibility of relief. And so we relieve ourselves of our anger by maybe catharsis, expressing it, or through acts of revenge, or whatever. And they said, you know, often watching the execution, there was kind of momentary relief, but they were still plagued by their resentment and their anger for years afterwards. The holding was still there. To be released is to somehow have untied dissolved the places of holding in our heart and the holdings in our mind. So forgiveness is a form of release. And sometimes it's forgiveness which is what's needed to help mindfulness take the next step to further our opening, further the purification of the mind and the heart. So forgiveness is a change of heart towards someone. It's the establishing of a right relationship or a healthy relationship, a relationship of goodwill towards someone, loving kindness towards someone. And in part, it's the accepting of the humanity of the other person with loving kindness and compassion. Forgiveness is sometimes misunderstood. Forgiveness is not forgetting about what's going on. Oh, I can just forget it. That's not forgiveness. I think that forgiveness is actually, like the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa, it was a bringing forth the truth which was needed before forgiveness could happen or reconciliation could happen. And sometimes with forgiveness, there's very strong memory. Memories last. It's not forgetting about what's going on. Forgiveness is also not excusing something, not excusing someone for inappropriate behavior or harmful behavior. It's not saying, oh, she couldn't help herself, or whatever. It's not excusing someone for something. I think with honest, healthy forgiveness, there's still the recognition that the person you're forgiving is responsible for what they've done, and they've done something very clearly that was wrong. And forgiveness is not saying, oh, it wasn't wrong, you know. Forgiveness is saying, yes, it was wrong, and recognizing it's wrong, I can forgive that person for it. And it's certainly not pardoning. It's not getting someone off the hook exactly, always. I heard an interview this weekend by, I forget her name, but the Guatemalan woman who got the Nobel Prize in Peace. And what? Yes. And she talked about she was very keen on having the person who tortured and murdered her mother brought to justice. And I had the sense that she was willing to forgive the person, but that wasn't a substitute for justice. So sometimes the things that follow through, but forgiveness itself at the core is where the holding of the resentment, the desire for revenge, is released from the heart or from the mind, and there's a reestablishment of a basic warm human relationship, a willingness to be in a warm relationship with that person in some kind of way, maybe at a distance, but some kind of open-hearted goodwill feeling towards that person. I've kind of in my life thought I forgave someone for something they've done, and then realized after some time that I was avoiding the person, didn't want to have anything to do with the person ever again. I don't think that's forgiveness. Maybe I'd kind of dropped some of the concerns and I wasn't so consumed by my pain anymore. But I like to think of forgiveness as not just simply dropping something, but dropping it enough so that's the natural sensitivity of the heart, the natural desire of the heart to be in a warm relationship of goodwill, is really reestablished. And I have this belief that fundamentally in the heart of each of us is this desire for goodness, and that takes that form if the forgiveness is complete. Now, one of the things to be said about forgiveness is we shouldn't forgive too easily, especially if the harmful behavior is continuing. It doesn't make any sense, I believe, to forgive someone if they're still hitting you over the head. I think the behavior that's going to be forgiven needs to have been stopped. And not only stopped, but I think it's very helpful if the person who's caused the harm recognizes they've caused the harm and maybe apologized or maybe kind of no longer identifies themselves with that kind of behavior. And that's part of the function of confession or admission, is or sometimes repentance or atonement, is a person changes who they are so they're not necessarily identified so strongly with that kind of behavior anymore. And then it's a lot easier to forgive someone. The Nicaraguans who forgave the Somoza regime, they only did it once they were in power. It didn't make so much sense to forgive them while they're still being hunted and murdered by the tens of thousands. Too easy forgiveness can be a sign of fear, of self-effacement, which are just different forms of closing down of the heart. If a person feels insecure or feels afraid and rather doesn't want to create conflict and therefore is willing to forgive, I don't think that's really forgiveness either. That's a different kind of hardening, different kind of blocks that go up. And sometimes to attempt forgiveness while the hurt is too overwhelming, it just doesn't make any sense. And sometimes, if some people have been really too traumatized, even to bring the word forgiveness up in conversation, almost like re-traumatizing them. It's better, sometimes people need to wait and do some of their own healing and create some of their own safety before it's appropriate even to talk about it or to begin the process. However, if we don't forgive eventually, the natural process of mindfulness that opens us and purifies the mind and the body, mind and heart, will be interrupted, will stop. And you can actually feel sometimes as the practice gets deeper, you feel like almost like a block, like a resistance, like something that keeps the practice from going any further. If we don't forgive, if we hold on to our resentment and our hate and our desires for revenge, then all kinds of unhealthy behavior can result. And to kind of continue in this kind of national level, I think that often various groups, political groups, politicians, sometimes use people's fear and people's resentment as a way of kind of fueling it to get more votes and to get people's participation. I think that there was a fair amount of resentment in the United States for having lost the Vietnam War. And I heard surprisingly shocking things during the Persian Gulf War about how America now had regained its pride. What a way to regain it, by fighting a war. Oh, this was interesting, I thought, by Gandhi. Gandhi said, "One cannot forgive enough, but the weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is an attitude of the strong." And then when Pope Paul II forgave the man who shot him, tried to assassinate him, there was a, this appeared in Time magazine. Some writer, a Time magazine writer wrote, "Not to forgive is to be imprisoned by the past, by old grievances that do not permit life to proceed with new business. Not to forgive is to yield oneself to another's control. If one does not forgive, then one is controlled by the other's initiatives and is locked into a sequence of act and response, of outrage and revenge, tit for tat, escalating always. The present is endlessly overwhelmed and devoured by the past. Forgiveness frees the forgiver. It extracts the forgiver from someone else's nightmare." And this points to an important element of forgiveness, and that is that forgiveness perhaps is not something necessarily you do for the other person, but you do for yourself. Because it's just too painful to go around anymore with a closed heart, with a painful heart, holding the resentment. So forgiveness is also nice to think of forgiveness as a process that begins with a simple intention or wish to start the process. It's not always so easy just to kind of overnight or just in a minute, you know, I'm going to forgive. Sometimes it might take months and years for the investigation and the learning what's going on and the sensitivity and the trust to develop within oneself so that forgiveness can happen. And that's part of the mindfulness, is to help us to understand ourselves deeply, but also to help us understand the other in a deep way as a human being. In both ways, by understanding ourselves and understanding the other, we can perhaps begin to empathize with the other person and begin seeing the other person who's caused the harm not so much as the abuser, and don't see ourselves as the victim, but rather see all of us as being human beings that we can empathize with, human beings with suffering, with shortcomings, who are struggling, perhaps with their own pain. Now, to understand ourselves, to begin investigating our resentment, our holdings, our grudges, not only is to understand the holding that represents, but more importantly, perhaps, the opportunity is to go further and understand the vision that fuels or creates the resentment. The vision, what I mean by the vision is perhaps like the sense of self, how you view and see yourself. Because often where so a lot of the difficulty can arise with being hurt is it ties in with some idea of who we think we are, who we think we should be. There are some people who identify extremely strongly with being the victim. And they almost need to kind of take that identity of being the victim, because that's how they prove to the world they are someone. And so it's not simply a matter of forgiving someone, but it's actually going deeper and seeing what is the image I have of myself that somehow has gotten confused with the behavior of someone else who's kind of attacked me in some way or other. And there's all kinds of ways in which our self-image, our vision we have about ourselves, is not really necessary. It's kind of optional. And sometimes to go deeply into the investigation into the nature of our self-concept and self-image is necessary in order for forgiveness to begin in a healthy way. So forgiveness is sometimes done as a meditation practice in much the same way that it's done as loving-kindness practice is done. And sometimes in our tradition, we'll do a forgiveness meditation before doing a loving-kindness meditation, because it's kind of hard to do loving-kindness if your heart is kind of clamped down with anger or resentment towards someone or towards oneself. So And just like in the process of loving kindness practice, it involves saying phrases, in this case phrases of forgiveness. But also in the same way as with loving kindness practice, it is not the point to feel loving kindness. It's not the point to end up forgiving, but rather the point is to find within us that intention that wants that, the intention of goodwill, the intention to want to forgive, and then putting phrases to that intention and resting resting in the intention, and letting that intention begin becoming stronger, develop some stability with that intention, and then with time the intention begins to work its way through our life. To try to do something, a lot of Buddhist practice arises out of the working, the almost invisible working of intention, the tremendous power of intention. So to begin doing the forgiveness meditation is a way of beginning to give form, perhaps, or strength to this invisible current of intention that begins working through us. And it's very simple. The usual classic phrases that we use in our tradition for forgiveness meditation are fairly simple. There's three parts. First, do forgiveness to anyone who has harmed you. And then to do forgiveness, ask for forgiveness from anyone who you have harmed. And the third step is to ask for forgiveness for any harm you've done to yourself. Because sometimes that's where the resentment lies, the anger. So the phrases are, for whatever harm I have done, either intentionally or unintentionally, to someone else, may they forgive me. And the second one is, for whatever harm, intentionally or unintentionally, someone has done towards me, I now forgive them. I now begin the process of forgiving them. And then the last one, for whatever harm, intentionally or unintentionally, I have caused myself, I now forgive myself. And a person might do that, sit there for 5 minutes or 10 minutes in meditation, just kind of repeat those phrases, and perhaps occasionally bringing to mind some person who this is pertinent towards. And just kind of, you don't have to forgive them, you don't have to kind of dissolve your heart's resentments and holdings, but to begin kind of feeling what it'd be like, feeling what the resistance is, feeling some of the issues that might come up. Maybe many conflicting feelings and emotions will come up as you begin raising this possibility of forgiveness in your heart. And then some people then will get conflicted around the conflicted feelings. They get, oh, I'm doing it wrong, or something terrible's happening, I'm feeling more closed down, and I feel all the shame or whatever. But actually to be very compassionate and gentle and accepting of the different kind of things that begin floating up to the surface as this intention begins. It's kind of like, intention is kind of like a soap. You know, you put soap, laundry soap in your wonderful, you put clean water in your washing machine, you put the soap in, you put your dirty clothes in, the soap has the function of taking all the dirt out of the clothes and makes the water dirty, right? So the intention is kind of like that. It kind of works like this wonderful detergent in our inner life. But it has to, the stuff that is being cleaned out has to come out. And so you see it. And so now you've been warned. You know, just take it as being a cleansing process and just, you know, rather than something to be concerned about or upset about when it appears. It's nine. I'd like to maybe then end with a couple of quotes. I was lent this wonderful book on the subject of forgiveness. If you want to kind of grapple with some of the issues connected to this, this is a fascinating book. It's called The Sunflower, on the possibilities and limits of forgiveness. You are a prisoner in a concentration camp. A dying Nazi soldier asks you for forgiveness. What would you do? And it's a story of Simon Wiesenthal, who was a Jew in a concentration camp, didn't know whether he was going to live from one day to the next. His family and people are dying all around him in the concentration camps. And he was taken in, spirited into the room of a dying Nazi SS agent who then confessed the crimes he had done to other Jews, how he killed them, and asked Wiesenthal, as his kind of dying wish, if Wiesenthal would forgive him. For, you know, what a situation to be in. And he heard him out. He tried to leave a few times in the middle of the confession, but he heard him out to the very end. And when the Nazi had finished saying what he had to say, and the silence of waiting for the forgiveness, he walked out. He didn't forgive him. He just walked out. But he didn't know. You know, what should I have done? Was that the right thing? And so he did a very interesting thing. Then he writes a story, and then he sends the story to all kinds of interesting thinkers, religious people, and asks them for their response. And apparently this book came out maybe in the 70s or 60s or something, and then they reissued it recently with a whole new set of people writing about their take. One of the more interesting people I thought was Matthew Fox, our local ex-Catholic. But I wanted to, I was inspired to, so the Dalai Lama is one of the people who responds this time, and it's kind of, it's very nice what he writes, but I had no sense that he read the story. Here, I would like to relate a very interesting incident. A few years back, a Tibetan monk who had served about 18 years in a Chinese prison in Tibet came to me after his escape to India. I knew him from my days in Tibet and remember last seeing him in 1959. During the course of that meeting, I had asked him what he felt was the biggest threat or danger while he was in prison. I was expecting him to say something else. Instead, he said that what he most feared was losing his compassion for the Chinese. Isn't that something? What is the attitude? What is the vision you have of life, of your fellow human being, of yourself? What is the priorities and values that you invest so much importance to? Part of Buddhist practice is to clarify all these things very deeply, not because you have to assume someone else's ideas or values, but to kind of get to the bottom of your own, to the root of your own. And with that in mind, there's this interesting quote from a sutra. Some children were playing beside a river. They made castles of sand, and each child defended his castle and said, "This one is mine." They kept their castle separate and would not allow any mistakes about which was whose. When the castles were all finished, one child kicked over someone else's castle and completely destroyed it. The owner of the castle flew into a rage, pulled the other child's hair, struck him with his fist, and bawled out, "He has spoiled my castle. Come along, all of you, and help me punish him as he deserves." The others all came to his help. They beat the child with a stick and then stamped on him as he lay on the ground. Then they went on playing in their sandcastles, each saying, "This is mine. No one else may have it. Keep away. Don't touch my castle." But evening came. It was getting dark, and they all thought they ought to be going home. No one now cared what became of his castle. One child stamped on his, another pushed his over with both hands. Then they turned away and went back, each to his home. So what are your sandcastles? So that's enough. Yes, Bonnie.
I wonder if I could share a relevant, very brief story. When I was probably 6 years old, I was beaten up in the school bus by a boy in the neighborhood. And my memory was, it was because I was wearing a brand new coat, and I remember he ripped the buttons off and was he made some comments about the coat, which he couldn't afford himself. He was from a different neighborhood. And I thought about that incident over the years and wondered what had happened to him. And 30-some years later, which was 9 years ago, I went to my high school reunion that case. And I was wondering if he would be there and what was I going to say and would he remember about the incident. And and what had he become in his life. And I had fantasies he would, you know, be this terrible person, et cetera. And there he was, smiling, very handsome, nice-looking person. I could feel that there was a nice person there. And I went over to him and I said, "Lori, do you remember when?" And I couldn't even finish the sentence, and he said, "And I'm just so sorry, Bonnie, that I did that to you at such and such an age." And we hugged each other, and there was just this tremendous release. And he had become a narcotics agent.
Thank you. Beautiful.
Yeah, how do you contrast acceptance and forgiveness?
How to contrast them?
Yeah. What do you think is different?
I think that for me, the way I'm defining forgiveness this evening is that forgiveness involves not only a release of the resentment, but and accepting the other person as they are, including their faults in a sense, but actually allowing there to be a sense of goodwill to that person again.
But then doesn't that mean the difference is the resentment?
In what way?
Well, I mean, it seems like forgiveness requires judgment, right? As like a prerequisite to it?
I think so. Judgment in a good sense. I mean, you have to have a sense. Judgment requires discernment. You have to discern that what was what and who's responsible and what needs to happen. Acceptance, I mean, wise acceptance should also be very discerning and very wise about what's going on. Acceptance shouldn't be this kind of blanket, you know, you don't give people blank checks, you know, like a blank check of acceptance, you know, accept you as you are, you know. But I think it needs to come with a clear understanding of what's happening. And then acceptance is, you know, it's a complicated discussion in some sense. I talk a lot about acceptance as being almost a synonym for mindfulness, but you have to understand a little bit the nuance of what we're talking about. And I tried very hard last Thursday in Thursday class here to explain what I meant by acceptance. And I think some people understood what I was saying, but other people kept missing the nuance. And very briefly, it was in one sentence perhaps, the acceptance that I keep talking about is the acceptance that allows our hearts and our minds, our awareness, to stay open and non-contracted around what's going on. So the awareness itself, in the field of awareness itself accepts it and doesn't react. But there might be wise judgments and wise reactions and responses to the situation, but the heart itself doesn't close as a result. So it's not that kind of acceptance is not a judgment, either way. Last one, and then we should probably end. Yes.
I just wanted to share the title of a book. It's called Alma Ade, The Voice That Remembers, and it's the story of a woman who spent a Tibetan woman who spent 25 years in Chinese prison camps, one time and another. And at one point, she says, "If I began hating my imprisoners, what would I become?" And it reminded me of that when you said.
Yes. What would we become? I'm frightened to think sometimes, if I imagine, what I would have become if I hadn't started Buddhist practice. I would have probably been much more contracted than I am now. Frozen in various ways. So thank you all for the evening, and I wish you well.